up, everyone?
Hello.
Welcome to Movie Schmovie, episode number 26.
Yikes.
And a very big episode for us.
Huge.
Very stressful episode for
man,
us.
Man, I was losing sleep over this.
Yeah, we're both very indecisive people in general. And I think that having to come to a decision about what our favorite movies of 2011 are has been...
Good.
I've been taking sleep aids at night to try to catch
same,
up.
Same. I've been thinking about this. I've been trying to jam in all the movies that I missed towards the end of the year. Just because of the sheer numbers. Like, it's... so many movies. So many movies. So I just tried to watch them all. And I finally think I came to a definitive... Well, I'd like to
as
tell
as close me, as possible.
As close as possible.
Yeah, so I'm not going to lie to you. There's movies I tried to see. I just couldn't, you know?
Right.
And I feel
understand.
Bad. There's going to be movies on my list that... movies that didn't make my list because, you know, I was just lazy.
Right.
Wasn't able to, you know?
Yeah.
I'm a slacker when it comes to that.
All right, so to make this even more special, we did something interesting. So we're going to do our top 10.
Yeah.
But, so in the interest of not making things so... written in stone, we're going to talk about our bottom seven, right?
Bottom seven?
Our bottom seven first, and they are in no particular order. And then we talk about our top three, and those will be in order.
Yeah.
Okay, so...
It's going to be tough, man.
It's going to be really
Before
tough.
We even get to the tops, we agreed that this was so stressful that we have a list of what we are calling honorable mentions.
Honorable mentions.
You know, they maybe would have been on the list had we done a top 20 maybe.
Right.
Or
right,
top 15. But there's just not enough space.
Or top 30.
Top 30. All right.
All right.
So we've agreed that we're going to just run through these with no following up, no follow up comments.
All right.
No remorse. We would just at least feel good that we got them out and gave them their moment in the sun.
Okay. Who's going to go first?
I will go first.
Go ahead.
So my honorable mentions are, in no particular order, The Help, Take Shelter, Mission Impossible, Ghost Protocol, Crazy Stupid Love. This hurts me so much.
Okay.
And in the horror category, Paranormal Activity 3, Insidious,
mm-hmm.
Hannah, The Ides of March, Contagion, and The Descendants.
Okay.
What about you?
Mine, Moneyball, Rango, Lincoln Lawyer, Paranormal Activity 3, Hannah, Martha, Marcy, May, Marlene, Friends with Benefits, X-Men, Meek's Cut Off, Super 8, Crazy Stupid Love, Warrior, Planet Apes, Moneyball, Warrior.
You just said Moneyball, Warrior twice, and you basically said every film that came out in 2011.
Yes.
So good at cutting the fat.
All right.
So now that that's out of the way, and at least we feel a little good or a little better about it, because this has been literally, I feel like I'm stressed out, man.
I am.
It's been tough. Like when you told me you wanted to pick our top three, because normally, like when I do my 10, I don't rank them because it's just so hard because every movie's so different.
Right.
And, you know, you telling me that I had to put, you know,
at least three.
At least three as the three. Whew, man.
Right.
Okay, but you know, I was up for the challenge, so let's go ahead and kick it off. I'm gonna throw it at you. You can take your first film from your top 10.
Okay, my 10th one. One of the bottom seven is Bridesmaids. Okay, so I chose this movie because it was almost an all-female cast, and it was really, really funny, which I know it sounds like a pretty sexist thing to mention, but you're hard-pressed to find a movie that has an all-female cast this incredible that stands against any comedy pretty much in the past 5 years. You know what I mean? It's solid. The story is really, really funny. It's well put together. And I think that Kristen Wiig, Maya Rudolph, prove that they're very solid comedic actors.
Sure.
So, I don't know. I think that I mentioned that.
I was a fan of Bridesmaids. I feel like my problem with that was that it was built up so much for when I saw it.
Right.
But it was a super funny movie. I think it's amazing that it actually is Judd Apatow's, even though he didn't direct it, he produced it.
Right.
It's his highest grossing film.
Crazy.
Which blows my mind.
Right.
You know, a guy that's done films like 40-Year-Old Virgin, Knocked Up, Superbad, or had his hands in these films, that this film, you know, like you said, all female cast, amazing.
Amazing.
More power to
amazing.
You. You know, I don't know how I feel about a sequel that they're talking about, but
it might be bad. How do you feel about comedic or romantic comedies being mentioned.
Oh, yeah, we were talking about this.
In, like, Picture of the Year or stuff like that.
I think they need to be. I always have a lot of trouble, you know, when I hear things talked about, like, you know, with Oscar, Academy Awards, you know, Best Pictures, especially when they expanded the category, like, when it was, like, went from 5 to 10, and now it's at this weird hybrid this year where, like, it can go higher than 5 if the recipients receive, you know, a certain percentage of votes from the Academy members.
Right.
I think a film's a film's a film. I feel like when you talk about comedy, when you think about drama, mystery, horror, suspense, you're working on a genre, and each genre requires certain tools to make it work, you know, certain resources to make it work. And a film like Bridesmaids, a comedy like Bridesmaids, you know, it has it clicking on all cylinders. You know, I don't feel like you say that film does not deserve to be nominated for a Best Picture versus a movie like, I don't know, say like War Horse, which is, you know, I've yet to see, so it's a movie that won't be on my list. But, you know, how do you compare that? Because it is really apples and oranges.
It's really hard.
You know, it's in its field. You can't not say it's at the top of its field.
It is. Yeah.
And that needs to be in the conversation.
It's a little harder. Like I said, I kind of can't. It's harder for me to categorize Bridesmaids in the top.
Yeah.
Versus a movie about like murder and sex and espionage versus a comedy. I mean, but a good movie is a good movie. So you're right. I forgot to mention Melissa McCarthy.
Oh yeah, really, she's good, hilarious. Yeah,
good comedic actress. Hopefully we'll see her in more movies. So.
Cool. Yeah, I'm gonna throw out one of my bottom seven. I'm going to talk about a film called X-Men First Class. It was on your honorable mention list.
Right.
Saw the film this past summer. I'm a fan of the franchise to begin with. Always been a fan of the X-Men comics and the cartoons as a kid and growing up. And I just think that what Vaughn did with this film, Matthew Vaughn, the director, you know, I talk about revitalizing franchises, yada, yada, yada. Things becoming a little stale towards the end of the last sequel, mainly at the hands of Brett Ratner. But I loved the prequel of the aspect of this film. I loved seeing the backstory of Xavier and Magneto and you know, having James McAvoy and Michael Fassbender. Just an amazing film. I mean, for a genre film, it's weird to say it was amazing because it's like, you know, you use words like that for really powerful, gripping cinema in a lot of cases. But when you're talking about a comic book series, a comic book world, a universe, I just feel like X-Men First Class was something that not only picked up a series, but also kind of gave it a whole new framework to work inside of.
Mm-hmm.
You know, whether they wanted to pursue sequels coming off of where, you know, First Class left off.
Right.
But the thing about this film was that they spent a lot more time working on investing in the characters over some of the insane action and CGI pieces that, you know, X-Men... The last one did, you know, what is it, X-Men, X-Men United?
Yeah.
Or Last Stand, whatever the hell it was called.
I think it was the Last Stand.
The Brett Ratner one.
Right.
That was so horrible. It was horrible, terrible. But X-Men First Class was thumbs up for sure.
Definitely. So,
what else you got?
All right, so mine is a foreign film, and it is done by director Takashi Miike. So some of his older works kind of cover Ichi the Killer, Audition, really gruesome movies.
Definitely.
Now, this time around, this was released in 2010, 13 Assassins. 13 Assassins reminds me of the martial arts films from the 70s where the feel of it is just very raw. The conflict is just, I want to destroy this person. He is a terrible person. So 13 assassins get together to basically kill this warlord. And it's a suicide mission because this guy's like a dictator. He has armies of hundreds and hundreds of people and has 13 assassins versus all these people. Takashi, his best work in a long time. I mean, I love Ichi the Killer. Audition, also really good work. I mean, but those are really kind of very disturbing movies.
Sure.
And this was a comprehensive, well put together story. And I loved it.
Awesome. So. I would throw out next a film called Midnight in Paris. We actually had it briefly on our last episode.
Right.
It was one of your worst films of the year.
It was.
I actually thought it was one of Woody Allen's strongest films that I've seen in a long time. You know, I feel like he's so hit or miss sometimes with his mainstream efforts. Like, sometimes he does really well, like more recently with like a film like Vicky Cristina Barcelona, but then he misses right afterwards with a film like, I don't know, Match Point. I wasn't a huge fan.
Okay.
But nonetheless, Midnight in Paris, Owen Wilson, not to go too much into it, we did last episode. I just really, truly, just attached and was really invested in his character's journey to, you know, his such a need and a want to travel into the past and what he was obsessed with and his love for nostalgia and actually being granted that, you know, that opportunity. And while, you know, I think what he realizes throughout the film is that no matter how comforting or, you know, fulfilling in a short term, you know, nostalgia can be, it can also be kind of destructive in the sense that it's distancing you from people in the present, which is really, in a lot of cases, the only reality that a lot of us have any control over is now, you know, which is what he kind of comes to the realization of by the end of the film. But I think his journey from being wanting to, you know, having wanted to been in the past and in these roaring 20s to being understanding of what he can control is now, I think it's a pretty cool journey. And I really thought Owen Wilson did a great job. And, you know, kind of Woody Allen's pretty well known for his scripts and his screenplays and the dialogue, his talky films. And
yeah.
I found it really humorous and really affecting and was a big fan of Midnight in Paris.
Cool. Mine is... The Ides of March is a one that I wanted to mention. George Clooney's, I think, second or third movie. Leatherheads was before this. This is a solid, solid movie that has the intensity of an action film and really just has to do with politics and hiding very big secrets, kind of what politicians are known to do. And the conflict that exists between Ryan Gosling and George Clooney is one of the most intense sort of conflicts that I've seen in a movie in quite some time. And it's done so well because these guys are on the same side working together. And because of a couple lies and scandals, it forces them to kind of go head to head in some way. So I liked it. Ides of March, George Clooney, amazing in it. Ryan Gosling, Philip Seymour Hoffman, Paul Giamatti, Rachel Evan Wood, Marissa Tomei, solid. Also, Jeffrey Wright makes a really small appearance, but is very effective in the movie.
Yeah, actually, I was a big fan of Ides of March also. It was one of my honorable mentions. Just briefly to throw out, I really, the political thriller genre sometimes, you know, I can be a huge fan, and sometimes I literally would turn it off,
yeah,
you know, halfway through it if it's not, if the pacing's not right. And Ides of March, like you said, it just is like from front to back, it's like it's a well-paced thriller.
Right.
And yeah, Ryan Gosling, always a huge fan, and we'll be talking about him a little more later.
Okay.
The next film I want to throw out is a movie that everyone in the world knows about, and it's Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows Part 2. I was so torn with whether to have this on my list or not, only because I've always been a fan of the films, and I decided to keep it on my list mainly because of the appreciation and respect and thankfulness I have to a studio and a whole troop of filmmakers that were involved with this series and being able to tie it up and to make it go out on probably the highest note. I've always been a huge fan of The Prisoner of Azkaban as my favorite film in the series, but this film easily rivaled it. Watching Deathly Hallows 1 and 2 back-to-back is an experience in and of itself. But the emotional journey that we take with the characters throughout the entire series, at the end of this film, you know, and you had no doubt and no, you know, reservation or no regrets of what you've invested into this trilogy or into this series. Say trilogy, God. You know, and I think that, you know, you watching these kids grow up and the characters, even the teachers and everyone, the journeys that they go through as characters. And, you know, honestly, me having not read the books, the films were all I had. You know, I never read any of the novels, the Harry Potter novels. So, right. You know, I was waiting every year to find out which was going to happen next in this amazing franchise. And, you know, I'm not afraid to say it. I absolutely love Harry Potter, a grown man. And I know I'm not the only one out there. And Deathly Hallows Part 2 was beyond satisfying to me, and it's definitely in my top 10 of the year.
Okay. All right. So, my next one.
Your next one.
My next one.
As The Descendants. The Descendants. So, The Descendants.
Another George Clooney.
Another George. George it's Clooney. A love fest. I love this man. George Clooney, the Alexander Payne directed movie. He did Sideways, which was a little too pretentious for me. But he did Election, which is one of my favorites. And this movie was a perfect combination of really smart sort of real-life situations. And then the dialogue was really well done. The pacing of it is good. Hawaii, I'm in love with Hawaii. And I talked to you about that a couple times.
Yeah, I was
times.
Thinking about you when I saw
Man,
it.
Man, watching this movie really, really, really took me back to what I was feeling when I was there. It's a beautiful location. And there's this big contrast between the beautiful environment and all the pain that was going on. You know, you can kind of be in paradise and still be in hell in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
And having this gentleman who's losing his wife, and have all these really sad things unfold, along with his two daughters kind of finding out too, it makes it a very hard sort of subject to tackle. And Alexander Payne tackles it very well. And George Clooney executes it well. And his two daughters, played by Amara Miller and Shailene Woodley.
Yeah.
Shailene Woodley. Really incredible. I think that this movie is, in terms of just pulling my heartstrings, this is one of the best movies I've seen this year.
Yeah, I'm a huge fan of Alexander Payne. I saw The Descendants. It was on my list of honorable mentions. Very emotional film. I'm not going to add a whole lot more to it because you pretty much hit it on the head, but I do want to give it its credit. I mean, because I was a huge fan. I saw it a little late in the game. I wish I would have seen it when it was first released in theaters and I hadn't heard so much about it.
Yeah.
But Descendants is definitely good stuff. The next film I'm going to talk about, we actually did a review on this film early on in our podcast history, and it's J.J. Abrams' Super 8. This is kind of a trip back to, movies that I remembered as a kid. I mean, I think of movies like E.T., Close Encounters, Goonies, films like that about kids, you know, about extraterrestrial, about change, about things you're not comfortable with. And that's the cool thing is, like, I feel like the movie got a little bit of flack in terms of, it's like, is it an ode to Steven Spielberg films or is it just a complete ripoff? And I don't think it's a ripoff at all. I think it's in parts an ode and it's in parts J.J. Abrams' own thing. I think also a lot of the criticism in terms of how well all of the alien stuff was done. I mean, a lot of people said that, like, they thought the family and the kid stuff was amazing, which I completely agree with. But that the alien, you know, the actual creature and the attacks and all that stuff was kind of a second thought. And, you know, I kind of think that a little bit. I mean, I almost feel like that's a part of the film. Mm-hmm. I almost feel like that's almost intentional, that amongst all this crazy shit happening in this small town, this monster being on the loose and how crazy and chaotic it is, that these kids and their relationships with one another and with their family are what's really dictating what's happening in this film.
Yeah.
You know, this is a big picture film to me. You know, this is a thing that makes me realize that, you know, in this, the example being this alien, but in our real life, you know, the things that are perceived to be the most intrusive or the scariest things in the end are nowhere near as scary as things like losing a parent or, you know, a relationship being fractured with your best friend, mm-hmm. or not having a relationship at all with your father, you know, which are what this film really talks to. And that's why I fell in love with Super 8. And, you know, I got the Blu-ray as a gift for Christmas, and I've watched it twice since getting it. And I still love the film on multiple viewings, which I was concerned with from what other people had suggested. And I would definitely recommend Super 8. And, I thank J.J. Abrams for giving me a sense of, like, when I was a kid, you know, watching films like that growing up. So
it was really, really very, very, like you said, it's very nostalgic. And it was so well executed that I would suggest it to anybody. It's one of those movies that's so universal. The story is very easy to understand, and it's done so well that I feel like this is going to be shown forever and ever and ever and ever.
Cool, man.
It's one of those movies. All right, so it's my turn, right?
It is your turn.
Oh, goodness. So my next movie is A Separation. A Separation is a foreign film. It is an Iranian film. that involves a married couple that are faced with basically this decision on whether to stay in Iran or to go to America. Now, obviously, Iran has a lot going on. Violence and religious wars and things like that. And the wife in the situation, her name is Sanim in a movie. She's trying to leave the situation. She wants to leave America. And the husband...
Leave for America.
Yeah. And basically her husband does not want to do that because his father has Alzheimer's and is basically deteriorating. Now, this movie on the surface sounds like a typical sort of story. But what makes this movie so amazing is the dialogue is really intentional, very intense. Think Revolutionary Road. You know how Revolutionary Road was constant, kind of heart-wrenching sort of dialogue the whole movie.
Hard to watch at
back
times.
And forth. And that's how this movie is. I don't know much about the actors as they are all foreign.
Yeah.
But I can guarantee that if you see this movie, you will enjoy it. It's so intense. So intense.
It's like on every top 10 list I've read this year. A surefire best foreign film nomination for Oscars.
Yeah.
If not something else. A big thing that I've read about, a film again that I haven't seen yet, unfortunately, but speaking to where the female plays into, you know, the social mores and culture in Iran, like what their roles are, and and this film is from what I've understood and from what you told me, it really kind of calls some of those things into question and really examines them from a couple of interesting angles.
Yeah, but one of the coolest parts about it is this guy, he has kind of been reduced to his father's servant, and as a result has kind of lost what it is to be a father in a situation, and she becomes that father figure for everyone. She's everything for everyone.
Gotcha.
And as he's caring for his father, he starts to realize that he's losing her. He's losing his family. He's losing touch with who he is as a person. And it's often these emotional breakdowns that I think are amazingly captured on film. So, Separation.
Cool. Next film that I'm going to throw out there is going to be a film called The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, which I think we're going to talk about in a little bit.
Okay.
I think you're going to talk about it more than me, not to kind of give it away.
All right.
Huge fan of David Fincher's, huge fan of Daniel Craig's. Rooney Mara really impressed me in Social Network in the brief, you know, role that she had.
Right.
I don't know. I can't say that I've read the books. I don't know that I absolutely loved the original film. I really did like it, but I absolutely love this movie. I think it actually added a whole other level to the initial film. I think that Rooney Mara's portrayal of Lisbeth is completely different than Noomi Rapace. And I think that David Fincher's, whenever I think of him, I feel David Fincher films. I don't know if that makes any sense, but they have a look, they have a vibe, they have a feel, they have in terms of music to them. And I think that whole filter that you can apply to this film is what made this such a great film. And the opening credit sequence is amazing, one of the best I've seen in years, as well as the music again, working with you know, the same guys that were on Social Network, Trent Reznor and Atticus Ross, and you know, it just kind of, and that kind of music lends itself really well to Girl with the Dragon Tattoo.
Right.
Amazing film. For being a long film, paced very well. I'm a big sucker for pace, especially having seen the original and being very critical of what this film was looking like on screen, and I can't say that I ever once thought anything negatively about this movie from beginning to end.
Okay. All right, so I got a substitute, man. I have one substitute. I've never done this before.
Okay.
My top 10. All right, so it once was Submarine, and I think I'm going to replace it with The Skin I Live In.
Wow.
Starring Antonio Banderas.
Antonio. Better known as Puss in Boots.
And Alina Anaya. So this movie is about a plastic surgeon that basically has all these tragedies. And he basically creates this synthetic skin which can withstand anything because his wife actually burns to death in a car accident. Now, he basically is holding a woman in these chambers where he's looking at her on film, looking at her on a high definition TV because it's being filmed, and you don't kind of know where this lady comes from. And as the movie develops, you start to see where she comes from, and you realize why he is who he is, why his family is so dark, why he is handling it the way he's handling it.
Sure.
And that's all I'll say, because a lot of that unfolds on camera. It is one of the creepiest movies I've ever seen in my life. It reminds me of a combination of a Hitchcock film and an episode of The Twilight Zone. It's really,
that sounds cool.
Really strange. And I think that a lot of people, I heard that a lot of people hated it.
Mm-hmm. Man, yeah, I've heard a lot of negative.
I think that this movie is like top shelf creepy. And I think that it's done so well. It should do that. Any good movie that's supposed to be effectively giving you that feeling, it's doing its job if you feel that way. It's supposed to make you feel uncomfortable. It's supposed to be a strange movie. And his story is supposed to be strange. And he's supposed to be obsessed with some, with these sort of things about skin. I think when you lose somebody, lose a couple people, you lost a couple people,
yeah,
you start to obsess over things. And this is what a rich person would do if they obsessed with something like
that. If you had the resources.
If you had the resources, sure. You'd be the surgeon. So,
all right, cool. I'm going to throw out Rise of the Planet of the Apes. Wow. I can't even tell you how blown away I was by this movie. Middle of summer, I remember seeing Fright Night in theaters and being told by a friend of mine who had seen Rise how much I was going to love this movie. And, you know, this guy knows me pretty well. And, you know, I didn't want to let that kind of get my hopes up too much.
Right.
I'm a fan of the Planet of the Apes films. Like, as a kid, I remember my parents always watching them with me. Like, the original, you know, franchise with Charlton Heston and Roddy McDowall. I just always liked them. And, to be honest, I even liked the Tim Burton one. I think I mentioned that before on the podcast.
I loved it. I loved it, too.
I thought it was fun. And, I was like, why are they going with prequel? Like, and the movie had nothing going for it. Like, it didn't have much buzz at all. And then out of nowhere, this movie lands in the top half of my top films of the year.
Right.
You know, first off, I think that everyone's been talking about Andy Serkis and his motion capture abilities. You know, he was involved in Tintin as well this year, the Steven Spielberg film. And I think that in Rise of the Planet of the Apes, Andy Serkis basically plays the motion capture part of Caesar, who is the lead ape, who, if you've seen the old Planet of the Apes films, who's basically is the leader of the civilization that we first met. Back in the version of the film from the late 60s, early 70s. And completely stunning. Like, what emotion, what pathos this guy brings to this creature, this animated object on screen. It's in some cases beyond any of the work that some of the humans do. And in this film, or even some other films that we're talking about on this top 10 episode.
Right.
The what he does with the eyes and the motions and the gestures is just completely amazing. I think that some of the action scenes, some of the CGI, of all films done this year, my favorite CGI, period. The action scenes with the apes, different kinds, orangutans, everything. Apes riding on horsebacks. I mean, gorillas riding on horsebacks, chasing cops. I mean, just that scenery on the bridge and the fog, climbing up the cables. Just absolutely stunning. I'm literally on the edge of my seat watching this movie, and having seen it multiple times, do so with each viewing. I think that one of the good things also about it was how lean and mean it was at 90 minutes. There was no additional crap or fluff needed for this film.
Yeah.
I think that it was nice to say, hey, we're going to reboot a franchise, we're going to show you where it all started, and we're not going to put anything in here that we don't find necessary. And, you know, Rupert Wyatt, the director of this film, I hope he's involved with the sequels that come afterwards. Did an amazing job. A nice subtle performance by John Lithgow as James Franco's father. And I love where they rooted the intention of where these apes end up coming from, which is basically a cure for Alzheimer's. And it basically spurs, a reaction that creates something that, I don't know, in a weird way, I feel like mostly everybody probably wishes they could forget.
Right.
In a weird way. And great film. Absolutely loved it.
Rise of the Planet Apes is one of those movies that affected me. Like, I was watching it, and when the action was happening, it kind of, my heart was racing. Like you said, you were on the edge of your seat.
I think the part where Caesar says no, you know, I don't know if you remember that part.
Yeah, I remember.
It literally gave me cold chills. And this is like, you know, This isn't a new character. This isn't like something that's like, you know, breaking the mold or anything like that. This is just something that was done incredibly well. And at that point in the film, I had so much invested in that character and in that ape that when he said that, literally sent like just goosebumps throughout my whole body. Right. And it was amazing. Awesome.
All right. So I think the last of the seven bottom seven, I think this last one we share, right?
I don't know. Maybe.
Maybe.
What is
possibly?
It?
I don't know. Attack the Block.
We'll find out.
Attack the Block. Okay. Attack the Block is within my bottom seven. So what can I say about this movie that hasn't been said already?
We did do an episode.
We did do a whole episode. So I'm not going to talk about it too much, but I'll say that one thing that Steve and I have in common is that we grew up in an era where movies like Goonies and anything like Ghostbusters, all these movies.
Gremlins.
All these movies did something to us. When we watched it, they affected us. I feel like movies made now, it's not a coincidence that they aren't doing very well for some of them because they all kind of don't have the heart. And Attack the Block had the heart of a movie that was made in this time. The amount of love and attention to detail and relationships and the humor and the action and random acts of violence made this movie one of the most exciting movies that I've ever seen. So, Attack the Block.
I'm going to hold my follow-up to that for a few minutes because I'm going to probably throw that a little later. The last film I'm going to put out, this was a really tough decision for me. This, I guess you would say, the number four, but not really. The last of the bottom seven I'm going to talk about is a film called Warrior. This is a film that I've been raving about all year to my friends, to my family, to my coworkers. Warrior, it came out in the middle of the summer. I think that's the only reason that I don't have it higher on my list is because I haven't seen it all the way through since I saw it in theaters. Basically the story of two brothers who enter an MMA tournament for very different reasons. And, in the end, end up having to face one another. And this is the face-off not only of a physical combat, but of emotional, mental build-up over years of troubled childhood, troubled lives and their personal lives. And it just all comes to a head in one of the best sports films I think I've ever seen.
Oh, yeah.
I'm not a fan of MMA whatsoever. I've watched like three matches in my life. And, I can't say that I'm a fan. I watch them because they're, entertaining. But the investment that you have in these characters, whether you love or hate them, the two brothers played by Tom Hardy and Joel Edgerton, they just completely, whether you like them or not, one brother kind of is set up for a little more alignment, to like him and to root for him than the other brother. But you definitely see where they're both coming from. And you definitely see what they both stand to gain, not only financially, but personally and mentally and emotionally from these or from this match, from being a champion possibly. Nick Nolte, in an amazing supporting performance in the film, plays the two brothers' father. Jennifer Morrison plays Joel Edgerton's wife. Always been a fan of hers. Just a really great film. I think a film that upon repeated viewings would probably have pushed it into my top three. I just never really had the time with trying to watch the rest of these films at the end of the year. The other thing I want to say also about Warrior is that I think that now that it's on DVD, I think that it will slowly gain a lot more awareness and acknowledgement and respect. It did nothing at the box office. It flopped. It was a great white hope possibly for Lionsgate. It didn't do anything really. Hasn't gotten any acknowledgement at awards season at all.
Yeah.
Which really surprised me. I was really hoping at least something maybe for Nick Nolte. But I can mark my words, when Dark Knight Rises comes out next summer, I can almost guarantee you that this film will take off because people that see Tom Hardy as Bane, and if he's going to be as good as everybody thinks he is and, that we all hope he is, people are going to seek out the works of this actor. And Tom Hardy is a force in this movie.
He is, man. Like, Tom Hardy, I think the problem with all of this stuff is kind of us knowing this stuff and people not knowing it.
Yeah.
And kind of trying to convince people of how great Tom Hardy is It's unfortunate, man.
He's a physical presence just on screen if he didn't even talk. But his not talking sometimes is what gives it more than just a physical presence. Yeah. It's just not his looming physique. It's his eyes. Mm-hmm. It's his choice to not say something, you know, that really kind of affects you. And especially in this movie because he plays like a strong, silent, you know, soldier kind of guy. Mm-hmm. And he has his reasons for not talking. And you kind of learn those throughout the film.
Yeah.
But Warrior, please go see it. I'm a cheerleader for that film. I've been trying to rep that film for half of the year. So please seek that film out.
So we're getting to our top.
We made it. Top three, baby. Where's our little crappy drum roll, Luke?
All right. So my number three is Girl with the Dragon Tattoo.
Cool. Yeah.
David Fincher.
That's all you're gonna say, right? I didn't want to go too deep because I knew you were gonna throw it out there.
I mean, I think that we talk about remakes and stuff like that, and I hate remakes.
I love them at times.
Love them at times.
I am always up for it.
Right? Okay. Yeah. I'm not up for it. I already have a stink face sort of mentality when it comes to remakes because I feel like you're treading on the same sort of area that the first film did, and this is actually one of the best remakes I've ever seen. Honestly, it is the best remake I've ever seen. It tackles the same thing, except it shows a little different side to it. For example, the character Elizabeth.
Lizbeth?
Lizbeth? Is it Lizbeth or Elizabeth? Lizbeth. That's really a strange name. I thought they said Elizabeth in the movie. Maybe it's because of the accents. I thought they said that. Elizabeth, played by Rooney Mara. And I thought that her version of this character had a lot more depth than the first. I think that the relationship that she had with Daniel Craig's character, Mikael, was also very different than the first. It felt a lot more intense. Felt a lot more, like a lot more sexual tension.
There was more emotion, too.
More emotion. And even though she was like, you know, emotionless for a lot of the movie, when it came to him, she got very, and it kind of did this sort of, they kind of implied that she sort of sought him out in the beginning. I don't know if you picked up on that.
Yeah.
You know when she kind of talked about his history?
Yeah.
Yeah, I kind of feel like she sought him out. And that wasn't really covered in the first movie.
Sure.
Like this was.
Sure.
And I think that this movie was a great, great, great follow-up. If you're going to remake it and they're going to make two more, I'll watch it.
Shut yourself. All right, cool. Yeah. My number three. I cannot stress how much stress this is. This is like literally driving me nuts even reading this and looking at my list now. Because I just don't even know. These three films are so close in my heart for very different reasons. But I think for the number three film of the year, I'm going to probably go with Attack the Block.
All right.
You mentioned it. We saw it together early summer before it hit theaters. Holding hands. We shared popcorns. We had one drink, but two straws. You're really weird about sharing straws.
I am weird about that.
Anyway, the film, like Ronald said, kind of taps into some of those films like Goonies. You know, these London street thugs. They're so badass.
Yeah.
They boss people around. They steal women's purses and monies. They ride their bikes and have their bats, and they're so hard. And then aliens come, and they ain't shit.
Yeah.
And I love it. And I love just seeing them squirm. Comedy. You know, Nick Frost has a small role in it, if you know him from, like, Shaun of the Dead and Hot Fuzz. I think Edgar Wright had a production hand in this film. And it has a little bit of that tone in it as well, where you have, like, the sci-fi, horror, thriller going on, but then you also have, like, little bits of, like, really, really funny parts.
Yeah, definitely.
And movie that moves super quick. And the little, if anybody that's ever seen the 80s horror film Critters... Mm-hmm. Late 80s horror film Critters, little fur balls, you know, these little monsters with fur, that are just balls of fur with eyes, you know, bluer than the ocean electrified.
Yeah.
You know, it's just awesome little monster, you know. It's so scary that you don't see anything, but you see everything.
Yeah.
You know, and they kind of just lurk in the dark. I just thought it was so much fun. You know, it just like that's what movies are. And I kind of miss that a lot of times. I miss being able to go to a movie theater sometimes and not, like, think so hard. not pay so much attention to every little plot device so that, you know, I don't miss something.
Right.
Sometimes I just want to commit and almost be one of the characters in the film and just kind of go along for the ride. Yeah. And that's exactly what this film did.
It
Attack
like,
the Block was a 100% blast. And if you have not seen it, you have to see Attack the Block.
Yeah. I think that when we went to go see it, the audience wasn't prepared for what it was.
At all.
And,
at all.
And I felt really comfortable. I'm normally not comfortable with a call and response. That everybody yelling at the screen sort of thing.
Yeah.
And everybody was really into it. And I felt it. Like, it was a great movie.
Yeah, you almost felt like you wanted to interact a little bit.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, a blast.
So, my number two is Drive. My number two is Drive. I think that Drive is, man, it's almost tied with the number one that I'm going to mention. But this movie was, it was one of the movies that I felt like it changed things for me. There's a couple movies in my life, and this is a weird thing to kind of talk about, but I kind of lost my faith in sort of mainstream movies for a little while. And this isn't exactly a mainstream movie. But the sort of feel of movies feels very synthetic and unintentional and uninspired. And this is one of those movies that was the complete opposite. Everything in this movie felt intentional, beautiful. The soundtrack, the outfits, it was almost like a silent movie on Ryan Gosling's end. He didn't talk very much at all, but it was really well done. I can't stress to you how beautiful this movie was. On top of it just being good, the pace of it was incredible. Starts off slow, then when it picks up, it's unrelenting. So I think that this movie, yeah. I don't know, man.
It deserves that just pause.
Yeah, just a dramatic long, pause. Dramatic pause. See Drive as often as humanly possible. January 30th, 2012, I will be buying a Blu-ray, which I never do.
He never buys a Blu-ray. He's talked me out of buying them.
I never buy media. We'll buy this.
All right. My number two film of the year is going to be Bennett Miller's Moneyball. I say that I'm a huge fan of baseball. I love sports in general. Baseball is my pastime. I played it in high school, college, and I have a place in my heart for that sport. I understand the thought in it, and I understand the deliberateness of it, or the deliberateness? Is that a word? How deliberate it is. And, I mean, on paper, you think about a movie about, you know, about baseball, about math, about a team who doesn't win, you know, the big thing in the end. You know, about a lot of the backroom politics, it doesn't sound like it'd be like an entertaining film or a successful film or a film that most people and maybe even myself as a fan would want to watch. Cause I want to watch the movies where they win the World Series.
Yeah.
I want to watch the movies where they overcome everything and it ends on a, you know, happy note.
Right.
And you know, Moneyball really isn't that. It's a true story of the Oakland A's. And, you know, I think that one of the big things that it touches on, you know, about sabermetrics, which was this whole idea of not building your team off of who was the most expensive player or who was the most popular player, whatever you want to call it. But you were actually building your team off of a formula almost of, you know, getting people on base, you know, who got on base the most, what was the likelihood that they would be able to get on base. And, you know, it really allowed the Major League Baseball world to readdress how they, you know, traded players, drafted players, you know, balanced their payroll, things like that. You know, and I think that when we talk about the 2002 Athletics, which is, you know, who the film is based on, you know, with when I think they had a salary of like in the low $40 million range versus a team like the Yankees who had three times that much salary. And for a team like this to make a run at the pennant, you know, in that day and age was completely ridiculous. People were criticizing and just basically making a mockery of Billy Bean and saying what you were doing is ridiculous. And I think that Bennett Miller's approach to this film, the character played by Brad Pitt, I think that this is probably one of Brad Pitt's best performances. And I mean, we mentioned it when we did our full-length review, kind of like just tapped into like a Robert Redford quality, which I was in love with. just makes it such an entertaining film to watch. You know, touching on, you know, his family and Jonah Hill also in the film. Amazing performance by Jonah Hill, who, I don't know, like, I don't ever think that I would have... I don't ever think that I would have read an article and said, oh, Jonah Hill is in, like, a drama with Brad Pitt written by Aaron Sorkin. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And his character that he plays is based on the guy, you know, Paul DiBattista, who is one of the guys that kind of, I guess, what is one of the, at the forefront of this whole Sabermetrics movement. And just a really great performance. I mean, you see characters in the film, you know, played by actors, playing real-life baseball players, and everything like that. But I think in the grand scheme of things, when I watch Moneyball, I not only see a baseball film, you know, it's like a double header for me. I see a baseball film about success, about change, about going against the grain. And I also see a film about a guy who tried to do that, you know, about a guy that was ballsy enough to try to change something. And if you look at baseball now, so many teams approach it like that now. Years later, when the Boston Red Sox won the World Series, it was open. It was public knowledge that they did so by adopting an approach very much like the one that Billy Beane did with his 2002 Athletics. And he was even offered a job with Boston, you know, at that point.
Right.
And he turned it down. But I love Moneyball. I love baseball. I love Brad Pitt. It was a great combination for me.
Moneyball is incredible.
Huge film.
I'm not going to talk about it forever, so I'll just say it's incredible.
Yeah.
All right. So, my number one. I didn't talk to a lot of people about this movie. So I am going to unveil it on you guys. So it's The Artist. So
I think you should say how much you love this movie without talking. No, I think it should all be, you know, just silent language. And because it's an audio podcast, you're just screwed.
Right, exactly.
I just get to watch and enjoy how much you love this
My
film
head just
by
did.
Your hands and your eyes and your smile.
Right, right.
And your nostrils flaring.
So this was directed by director Michel Hazanavicius. I know that sounds ridiculous. I had to write the phonetic spelling. But this is basically a story about a Hollywood actor. His name is George, and he's basically the top silent actor of the time in the 1920s. And he's approaching a time where basically spoken film is starting to approach. And his generation is kind of fading away. So it's a silent film about a silent film, about silent films. And it is probably one of the most effective uses of 100 minutes that I've ever seen in my life. I've never said that about anything. It's probably one of the most effective uses ever of 90 to 100 minutes. The soundtrack is incredible. It has style, substance. It's refreshing. I've never seen anything like it before. It's beautiful. Ludwig Borsch, one of the, he did the soundtrack, the composer, kills this thing, man. It's incredibly done. Every little piece of music makes you feel some kind of way. Every emotion that's supposed to be shown on film is expressed through the music. It's like he watched it first and then composed it as he was watching it. This movie is why movies, the type of movie that inspires someone to make, an amazing movie. It inspires all the great actors, all the great directors, people that love good cinema will love this movie. I know it's weird because it's silent, but The Artist is one of the best films I've ever seen in my life.
Awesome. Yeah, I haven't seen it yet. I mean, again, a film that, among many others that I didn't get to see this year, like The Artist, and I didn't see War Horse or Separation. Tinker Tailor, I wasn't able to see, but I have heard amazing things about The Artist, and I'm definitely up for the challenge of seeing a silent film. I can't say that I've ever watched a silent film before.
Hope you enjoy it.
And I'm really, really looking forward to it. And I'm going to close it out, man. I'm going to bring it home for the home stretch.
The closer.
I'm gonna throw my number one out there for the year. You've mentioned it. We've mentioned it before. It's Drive. I don't know what else I can say about this film. I think, I'm a huge fan of Ryan Gosling. I think his performance in this film, while it's kind of very, I guess, subtle in a lot of ways,
mm-hmm.
I think it is his slow simmer in his character, the driver, and how subtle it is that makes this film work so much. One of the big things about this film is that there's nothing extra in this movie until it absolutely has to be.
Yeah.
And when it is huge. You know, whether it's violence or it's, you know, a kiss or it's an escape, you know, a getaway in a car or a shotgun going off on somebody's body. Whatever it is, when it happens, it's big. Yeah. It's effective. Like, you keep using the term effective. And and that's what I think makes it work a lot of times. And in a lot of movies, you overdo it too much. You almost have that, I don't know that it's so much like, you know, the boy who cried wolf, you know, like things happen so much, you lose the importance or you lose the effect that it has on you when it's a little more sparse, you know, it's kind of used with a little more, it's a little more intentional, you know what I'm saying? And I think that's one of the things that really makes Drive so amazing for me. I think you mentioned the style, you know. Just when we saw it, and like that opening song, and like, you know, the title treatment pops up in the pink calligraphy, and we're just like, oh, dude, come on, we want to live there,
right?
You know, I think that the music, the look, the film has like kind of like a Michael Mann 80s vibe to it, almost like a To Live and Die in LA kind of thing, or a Miami Vice kind of thing. The world that this film takes place in is like I said, some place that I feel like I would want to hang out.
Yeah.
It's pretty probably weird. Not in that world, because I don't want to get my ass blown off, my head blown off. But I think, you know, it's so big. While we're so focused on these characters and these situations, it's such a big and thick environment that you almost can't help but feel a part of it in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
I think another thing, it was nice seeing Albert Brooks and Ron Perlman in the film in smaller roles, but especially Albert Brooks as a bad guy and a fucking awesome bad guy. I think he'll probably get an Oscar nomination for supporting actor, which was awesome. Cliff Martinez's score. I'm not a big like electronic fan, you know. I don't really react to it too much, but this is the score that I actually bought the soundtrack for and listened to it regularly. And one of the biggest things I think of, if I could summarize Drive, is that it's an action film of quiet power. I think that it's a film that was marketed a little inappropriately to maybe made to look like a Fast and the Furious or a Gone in 60 Seconds or a Transporter kind of film. And it couldn't be further from that. I mean, I feel like when this film gets violent, the Transporter looks like Wizard of Oz compared to it.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
Definitely.
But then a lot of people went in looking for that nonstop, overdone action fighting thing, and it's not that. And I think that hurt a lot of people's reaction to the film, and I wish they could maybe give it another shot. It's gotten lots of love from, you know, critics and, you know, a lot of viewers and listeners of our podcast even, but oddly enough, not a lot of love through the Oscars and stuff like that. Golden Globes got nothing. It's gotten some critic circle nominations and accolades, but I'm curious to see if it gets any Oscar love.
I hope it does.
You know, one would hope it would. I mean, like you kind of alluded to with your brief review of it, Drive is a movie that you watch every year. You see a movie like this every year, every two, every 3 years, and it's like a, it's like somebody opened the door and let some air in. You know, like, you know, things get so stale and so played out, and some people just don't react to a film like this because it seems so, so different, or like, you know, so not like everything else, and you're so used to everything else that you don't know how to react anymore.
Yeah.
And it kind of either, one, makes you check yourself and react like, you know, kind of like we are and most moviegoers that have seen the film have, but Drive, amazing film.
Amazing film. One thing I wanted to say also is that the director respects violence in a way that I haven't seen violence respected.
Oh, definitely.
The fact that, here's the thing, when you kill someone, it creates a ripple in everyone's life around you.
Yeah.
It's not like
a standalone thing.
Right. It's not like a Rambo thing where you kill 10 people, then it's okay.
Yeah.
Literally, when you kill someone, it's a terrible thing. It affects people, and you will pay for your consequences.
Absolutely.
And this was one of those movies that made this very real to me. I loved it. It was so well done. Gah!
Amazing.
Drive.
So what we did also, that's basically wrapping up our films of 2011. It's been an amazing year of film.
Yeah.
It's been an amazing year working with you, Ronald. I think it's been, we've had a lot of fun doing this podcast, and we're going to keep it going. But what we did was, like, we opened it up to some of our listeners,
right.
And we said, hey, do you want to, you know, record something, call in a little audio recording, or send us something that you recorded yourself of what your favorite film or films of the year have been. And we got pretty decent response from some listeners that have commented on our page, or, you know, just friends of ours that we know follow the podcast. Mm-hmm. And so what we did is we took all the files that we had sent in, and just so that we could give them, you know, their moment in the sun and to thank them for listening to our podcast, what we've done is compiled a list of the friends of Movie Schmovie and their top picks of 2011. And here they are. So take a listen.
Hello, Movie Schmovie listeners. This is Dakar from the Crazy Gamers podcast. And when I'm not doing crazy gamer things like handing out kill streaks in Modern Warfare 3 or getting lost in the world of Skyrim, I'm watching movies. And I love movies. Number one goes to The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. Absolutely love this flick. I was a little apprehensive with the movie adaptation, but I was not let down at all. And I'm a David Fincher fan, so I knew it was going to be good. So, Ronald, Steve, thanks for keeping us entertained, and we all look forward to more Movie Schmovie. Talk to you later.
I thought long and hard about this, and I decided it had to be a movie that I saw twice this year. And that narrowed it down to two choices. Either Sherlock Holmes, the one I most recently saw, or Harry Potter. And I'm going to go with Harry Potter. I know it might be a common choice, but the acting was fantastic. It was a great ending to the conclusion, or a great conclusion to the series. And even though it wasn't, you know, picture perfect with the book, and there were a few parts I wish they added, considering it was a shorter runtime than normal, I got to give it up to Harry Potter, Deathly Hallows Part 2.
Hey, Movie Schmovie listeners. So Steve and Ronald asked me to share my favorite movie of the year with you, and it was a really tough decision. I was kind of going back and forth between a few other films, but I had to go with my initial instinct, which was Drive. This movie had it all for me. I love that it wasn't a typical blockbuster action movie, and instead it was kind of the tone of more of like a gritty, darker drama. I thought the cast did a great job. Ryan Gosling was the perfect actor for the male lead. After seeing this, I couldn't think of any other person who would have done a better job with this part. Basically, everything about this film just came together for me down to the soundtrack. I was completely interested from start to finish. I feel like in the few months it's been since I saw it, I've recommended it dozens of times over. So, yeah, Drive was my favorite film of 2011.
This is John from Baltimore, and the movie I'd like to recommend doesn't actually make it to theaters until February 3rd of 2012, but I saw it at a film festival last fall, and it was on demand on December 30th of 2011. So, don't start with me, Movie Schmovie. I will fight you. The movie is The Innkeepers. It's written and directed by a guy named Ty West, who's kind of an up-and-coming auteur in the horror genre. He's a real master of tone and pacing. And even his shot compositions, everything is geared towards creating this sense of dread. What he's doing in The Innkeepers is interesting because he's taking what could be kind of a trite or familiar ghost story, and he populates it with these great characters, Claire and Luke, who are co-workers at a supposedly haunted hotel, and they have this nerdy bond over the ghosts that may walk the halls of the hotel. You know, the movie's a slow burn, so there's time to really catch up with them and get to see what type of friendship they have. And it's very relatable and endearing, so you're more invested when the scares do come. It's that rare horror movie where you aren't just sitting there waiting for something awful to happen to everyone.
Hey guys, Scott in Baltimore here, and my pick for the best movie of 2011 would be Drive. So the reason I like this movie, one, I love the look of it. I love this this modern feeling and look they have to it, but it kind of feels a little more like that late 70s or just like in the 70s when they put out a lot of these types of movies, and they cranked out a bunch of them, and they were all really good. I'm a soundtrack nerd. I love the soundtrack to this movie. A real big fan of like the score. Being a fan of the craft of screenwriting, I really like the conventions they broke with, such as the backstory of the protagonist, which is really not there, but you still are able to feel for him, which, you know, it's okay to break the rules of screenwriting, boys and girls, everybody out there that's taking these screenwriting classes or reading these books. It's okay if you know why you're doing it and you can make it work. And it's a hard thing to do. So I think it's really a hallmark of a good writer that can sort of abandon some of these tried and true rules and still make the story work. And that's sort of the total package, the writing, the look, the acting, for me, that total package is why I chose Drive as the best film of 2011.
I'm a big fan of Movie Schmovie. I listen every single week to hear what these guys are going to say. It's funny, get their thoughts on movies, see what I'm going to agree with, what I'm going to disagree with. There's one thing I definitely disagree with Steve on. That's the unnecessary remake of movies that were made perfectly well just a few years ago. So no matter what he says, Let the Right One In, we didn't really need Let Me In. The Spider-Man reboot coming out this summer that we can all already hear Ronald complaining about the horrible CG in, Steve will probably embrace that wholeheartedly. So you can understand my skepticism when he told me that I would really enjoy David Fincher's The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. No matter how great of a director Fincher is, these movies were done amazingly well just a few years ago and are still streaming heavily on Netflix. They're fresh in my mind, so I couldn't imagine what would possibly be done that would make me interested in sitting through this for 2.5 hours. Damn it if that didn't turn out to be my favorite movie of the year. Steve, in this particular case, you were right.
So yeah, some great picks there. Great picks.
A lot of them we had on our list too.
Yep.
So, thank you for your contribution. They have good taste, just like us.
Yeah.
Some of them.
Not so much for some of us.
Yeah, but thank you guys so much. Like, seriously, things like that, something small we can do to kind of get you involved, and thank you for listening. You know, and this is a podcast for you because, you know, we're just like you. We just go to the movies and hang out and watch and talk about them just casually. So thank you all for, you know, those of our listeners who submitted the, you know, their top picks of the year. We appreciate the time that you took to record it and even just, you know, for writing back to our messages. It's awesome. Be sure to tell your friends to check out the podcast. Movieschmovie.net's our official site. We're available on iTunes to subscribe to. We have a Mixcloud. Something that I messed around with over the weekend, if you have an iOS device like an iPod, an iPad, or an iPhone, get the Mixcloud app.
Yeah.
You know, if you make the account and just favorite our podcast, every time we put a new one up, it'll tell you there's a new one.
Yeah.
You know, you don't even have to do anything except for just hit the little heart button, and it'll tell you every time we put a new episode out. It's pretty awesome, man. Yeah. If you don't use iTunes and you don't, for whatever reason, another alternative for you to be able to listen to us.
Mixcloud.
But yeah, guys, thanks so much for listening. Be sure to stay tuned. We have some pretty cool reviews coming up in the next few weeks. And I personally am really excited for the Academy Awards coming up, in a few months.
You and I both. And, The Super Bowl of
motion pictures.
Award season.
Yeah, man. And we'll definitely do an episode where we do our picks, and hopefully you guys can be a part of that as well. So as always, thank you so much for listening, and you've made our day. Talk to you soon.
All right.